Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world. One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 15th of May, these are our main stories. Votes are being counted in Turkey's most closely fought elections in decades, which could end Recep Tayyip Erdogan's grip on power. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has arrived in France after visiting Italy and Germany to discuss more military support to fight Russia's invasion. Reformist parties appear to have won a convincing majority in Thailand's parliamentary elections. Also in this podcast, the actors Ben Whishaw and Kate Winslet are among the big winners at this year's British Television Awards, the BAFTAs.
It really does mean that small British television dramas can still be mighty. Thank you. Thank you to my fellow nominees.
Let's start in Turkey. As we record this podcast, the country is on tenterhooks as votes are counted in the country's most tightly contested elections for years. Tensions are running high as conflicting results have been coming in, with many questioning whether the man who has dominated Turkish politics for two decades, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, will accept defeat if he loses. Turnout was extremely high at a time when anger over soaring inflation and the authorities' handling of recent devastating earthquakes has weakened Mr. Erdogan's stranglehold on power. Victoria Craig is a reporter based in Ankara. She told me what the mood was like at the headquarters of the main opposition party, the CHP.
It had been really chaotic, very tense, and now it's sort of everybody's running out of steam, I would say. You know, it's past 1 a.m. here. I think everybody's really tired. The vote's very close. It's too close to call. About 95% of the votes have been counted. Neither candidate has the critical 50% threshold and above needed to prevent a second round vote. It's currently standing with President Erdogan at about 49.5% to Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu's 44.6%. The opposition has also taken this country's three biggest cities. And as you alluded to in your intro there, the voter turnout has been very high at more than 88% of the vote. So very tense mood still here tonight.
Very tense mood. And there's been some confusion about the figures as they've come out throughout the day.
Yeah, exactly. And that's due to when various agencies were getting the data. The opposition has also alleged that part of that confusion is due to recount requests in various districts from the AKP. Importantly, those discrepancies have narrowed as the night has gone on. And so the data between the two agencies has sort of come in line. We just heard from a very stern Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu here who pulled all the press aside very briefly, 2 or 3 minutes, and very pointedly made a plea for those tallying the votes or releasing the figures not to, quote, be afraid of the will of the people and not to block the will of the Turkish nation. And he vowed to stay until each vote is counted. He certainly does not seem in any way ready to consider defeat.
Yes, he's the main opposition challenger, but it's well known that President Erdogan will fight with all he's got to try to hang on. So a lot at stake for both these men, but also a lot at stake for Turkey's allies.
Especially, yes, a lot at stake when it comes to the economy, as you said, and as we heard from those people here voting for the first time, it's by far the biggest issue for voters. Opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu has pledged to return to more conventional, more normal economic policy to ease the extreme cost of living crisis that we're seeing here. Inflation officially topped out at 85.5% in October. But also, as you say, the world is waiting to see what direction this country is going to take, especially with regard to its relationship with Russia. President Erdogan has balanced very finely friendships with both the West and Russia. If you remember that grain deal that he helped strike between Russia and Ukraine to get very much needed food supplies to the rest of the world last year. So very high stakes election, lots of issues on the table, and the world is watching.
Victoria Craig in the Turkish capital, Ankara. Ukraine's president, on his first visit to Germany since Russia's invasion last year, has called Berlin a true friend. This comes a day after Germany announced a $3 billion package of military aid to Ukraine, its biggest since Moscow's full-scale invasion. It's a remarkable turnaround for Europe's largest economy, which was accused of a hesitant response at the start of the war as it worried about provoking Russia. Our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill told us more about the significance of this trip.
Just over a year ago, it would have been unthinkable for Germany to send weapons into a conflict zone. But that has changed. We have seen Germany being reticent when it comes, for example, to sending heavier weapons, for example, tanks. But that reticence was overcome. The hesitation was shared also by some other allies. The amount of money, the amount of military help that Germany is now sending makes it actually the second largest donor, second only to the US. And there was, I think, a genuine warmth, actually, between President Zelensky and Chancellor Scholz.
So, a huge military aid package, lots of warmth between the two leaders. But what Ukraine really wants is fighter jets. Any sign that Germany is agreeing to that?
Germany, like some of the other allies, have concerns around the supply of fighter jets, modern fighter jets. Those concerns range from the logistics. They say, some people say, that it would be difficult to train fighters to use those jets in Ukraine. The main concern in Berlin, though, and we heard this from Olaf Scholz today, is that he doesn't want to supply weapons which are anything other than defensive. He doesn't want to send anything that could be used by Ukraine to target Russian territory and therefore potentially escalate this conflict. President Zelensky, of course, has always said, well, the Ukrainians wouldn't do that. Now, we don't know what happened behind closed doors this afternoon, but there were talks with the German Security Council, and President Zelensky had said he was going to bring up the idea of an alliance of countries who would be willing to provide fighter jets, and he hoped that Germany would join that alliance.
And how do Germans feel about all this support for the war in Ukraine? As well as supplying military aid, they've also taken in many, many Ukrainian refugees.
I think Germany is somewhat divided. If you look at surveys done by public broadcasters, for example, they show that still there is a majority of public support for the delivery of weapons to Ukraine, but that there is a section, a fairly sizable section of the population, which has concerns about that and thinks that it's time to start negotiations to end this conflict. And I think all along, that's what Olaf Scholz has been keeping a really close eye on. I know myself from fairly senior sources that he's been really concerned that he doesn't want to move, for example, send in battle tanks, knowing that the public aren't fully behind him.
Jenny Hill in Berlin. Mr. Zelensky had arrived in Germany from Italy, where he held talks with its political leaders and also had an audience with Pope Francis on Saturday. After leaving Germany on Sunday, he headed to Paris. Where he was greeted with a military guard of honour at the Élysée Palace before going in for talks with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. I asked our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, whether France would follow Germany in pledging more military aid to Mr. Zelensky.
I don't think we should expect anything equivalent. At least that's not what we've been told to expect by the Élysée. There may be some announcements, but I don't think there'll be anything of that major order. What we've been told here is that this meeting is part of Zelensky's kind of efforts to coordinate with key allies in advance of an expected counteroffensive, which hasn't come, of course, but which, you know, may well come, and in advance of other forums like the G7 meeting that's approaching in Japan. So I don't think we should expect anything kind of groundbreaking in the way of new arms deliveries, though, you know, France's kind of concern in that regard is still clear, and there may well be minor announcements there. But it's much more of a kind of general coordination that seems to be the issue here.
Mr. Zelensky, on this tour of Europe, first in Italy, then Germany, now France, is clearly looking to shore up support. What do the people of France make of the war in Ukraine? Are they still as strongly in support of it as before?
Well, I can't call to mind any recent poll figures on this, but nothing has struck me recently as suggesting that it's falling off in any way. Obviously, there is an ongoing hope in Moscow that they can play the long game and that eventually Western opinion will begin to weary of the cost and the repetitiveness of the war. But there's no sign of that happening yet. And in general, I would say the country is fully behind Macron's sending of arms to Ukraine. I mean, the France has sent the Caesar mobile artillery units, which are very, very successful out there. There's been light tanks. There's been air defense missiles as well. And, there's not been any debate about that. I mean, there's, I think, a big, big degree of support for that effort, notwithstanding the fact that, yes, you know, everyone is weary of the war and fed up with it. But I don't think there's any sign of support for the cause tailing off.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. One of the strongest storms to hit the Bay of Bengal in recent years, Cyclone Mocha, has destroyed buildings and left many people without electricity or Wi-Fi. Several people are reported to have died, but the sprawling refugee camps near the city of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, housing 1 million Rohingya refugees, have been largely spared. From Cox's Bazar, here's Rajini Vaidyanathan.
Cyclone Mocha arrived with force. As it intensified, so did the panic. People ran for cover as the winds picked up pace and the rain poured incessantly. Across this southeastern stretch of Bangladesh, more than 200,000 people were moved to temporary shelters, many staying in schools, sleeping on classroom floors or on desks, with very little food. Families who left their homes in low-lying coastal areas.
What's your name?
Sumi's worried she may not have a place to return to. Every year we wonder how we'll survive, she said. They need to build us stronger homes. Not too far away, in the world's largest refugee camp, close to 1 million Rohingya refugees were stuck in their flimsy bamboo huts through the storm. At least 500 shelters have been damaged.
Rajini Vaidyanathan in Bangladesh. A progressive opposition party appears to have won the most votes in Thailand's parliamentary elections. With almost all ballots counted, Move Forward was ahead of its nearest rival, Pue Thai. The two parties are on course to have a substantial majority of seats, but their efforts to form a government may be blocked by members of Thailand's Senate who've been hand-picked by the military. My colleague Julian Marshall spoke to Jonathan Head in Bangkok.
Move Forward is a new party. It's in fact a second version of a party that was founded only 5 years ago, which did well at the last election based on a huge amount of enthusiasm from younger voters. But its appeal has clearly broadened. Now, the electoral system has been changed in a way that is much less favourable to it. Because it's a new party, it doesn't have very well-established networks, it doesn't have lots of alliances across the country. But somehow this message of completely changing everything, and it's even willing to talk about the monarchy, which in the past has been a totally untouchable subject, has resonated. And we've seen some really quite extraordinary scenes where young people have, to a huge extent, taken to this party, but this isn't a particularly young country. The number of people under 26 is only about 14% of the electorate. But those young people have been getting their parents and grandparents out and really pushing them to vote, basically saying to them, we don't think we've got a good future. You should vote for this radical new party to give us a better future. And somehow it's resonated. Nobody a month ago predicted that this party, Move Forward, would be, basically it looks like it's won more votes than any other party and is going to be one of the two largest parties. Between them, the two opposition parties, Pue Thai, the traditional election-winning machine of Thaksin Shinawatra, are going to have a very significant majority of the seats in the lower house.
But the military has the final say, does it not, in who forms the next government?
Not quite. These 250 unelected senators are loyal to the coup leaders, the people who rewrote the constitution to favour themselves. So, of course, with 250 out of a total of 750, if you include the 500 seats in the lower house, of course, that gives them a huge advantage. But the two reformist parties have done so well. I think they've got momentum behind them. They only really need to get one more party, one of the middle parties, to join them, and they would be able to outvote even the Senate plus the Conservative parties. I think if, you know, those who have run Thailand for a long time and have always assumed that they could kind of fix elections that didn't go their way, if they read the room, I think they're going to realise that the public mood has swung so firmly against the old way of doing things, where the military and royalists behind the scenes kind of manipulate things, that hopefully they will see that they need to go along with this, that there needs to be a very different kind of government.
We've been talking parties, Jonathan, but is there a single figure whom you could maybe identify as emerging as prime minister in a new administration?
Well, if Move Forward has more seats even than Pua Thai, and that was something nobody predicted, its young, very telegenic leader, Peter Lim Jeurenrat, a very highly educated young man, a successful businessman in his early 40s, would be the obvious candidate. He's been in Parliament for the last 4 years, but he's relatively inexperienced. He certainly doesn't have a lot of experience of the kind of horse trading that will be needed to pull together a government. So I'm not quite sure how he'll pull it off. But if he has got more seats, and it's looking like that may be the case, I think you've got these two reformist parties almost neck and neck that no government can really be without. They've got such a large chunk of seats between them. They're going to have to work out between them who is going to be the most plausible prime minister and, to some extent, who's going to be most acceptable to the Conservatives. This is going to be a stunning blow to General Prayut, the man who's been prime minister the last 9 years, and all of the royalists and the military men and the Conservatives who've backed him.
Jonathan Head in Bangkok. Still to come. As Belarus celebrates its National Flag Day, many ask, where is its president, Alexander Lukashenko? We'll be back right after this.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic, and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world, One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The United Nations says the month-long war in Sudan has forced nearly a million people from their homes. Most of them are still within the country. Despite an agreement to protect civilians, both the army and the rival rapid support forces have continued to fight in densely populated areas, especially in the capital, Khartoum. Both sides are blaming each other for shots fired at a church on the outskirts of the city that injured people. There's also been renewed violence in the western Darfur region, with a rights group saying 100 people have been killed and a mosque hit. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more.
We were hearing a lot of reports from El Geneina, which is a large city where there's been quite a lot of violence for 3 or 4 days, we're hearing. Very difficult to get connection through to there, but we're getting some reports from rights groups saying at least 100 people have been killed. Others are saying the figure is three, four, five times that number. But the pictures we've seen have included a picture of the mosque that's partially destroyed, and apparently the imam of the main mosque was killed. And there's been basically shelling across the city in densely populated areas of the city, quite a lot of houses torched. And once again, as we've heard so often in Darfur, people having to quickly flee their homes. So it's a pretty grim picture, but one of the rights groups has blamed the violence on what he called Arab militias, and those are militias allied to the rapid support forces, the RSF.
And the RSF has also been accused of attacking two hospitals in the capital, Khartoum, at a time when there's a desperate need for them and most of them are closed.
Yeah, that accusation's come from the Sudanese government. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that the RSF fighters stormed two hospitals and assaulted staff as well as patients and then left with ambulances that they stole. It's difficult to confirm this, and we ought to add that throughout this now month-long conflict, there have been a lot of accusations flying back and forth, and we've had statements throughout from the RSF saying, we're not attacking civilians, we're abiding by all the principles, and it's the other side that's doing all the bad things, as it were. But we've got evidence of both sides using, you know, high caliber weapons in densely populated areas.
Will Ross, now to Belarus. Where on Sunday, the country celebrated its National Flag Day. But Belarus's 68-year-old leader, Alexander Lukashenko, a key ally of Moscow, was glaringly absent from the major state occasion, fueling speculation about his health. Instead, Mr. Lukashenko's message was read out by the Prime Minister. Rumours had already been swirling for days after Mr. Lukashenko's early departure last week from a Victory Day parade in Moscow, which meant he didn't attend a lunch with President Vladimir Putin. Our Europe regional editor is Paul Moss.
The event that Mr. Lukashenko missed is called the National Flag Emblem and Anthem Day. And here's the thing. Only last month, the Belarusian government announced that they wanted to have patriotism lessons in schools. And they explicitly said they wanted children to be more aware of their country's flags, emblems and anthems. So today's event is exactly the sort of thing you would expect Alexander Lukashenko to be promoting. And guess what? He doesn't show up. I've spoken to two academic researchers who specialise in Belarus. They both say it's highly unusual anyway for him not to be there. But in the wake of the patriotism announcement, it's even more remarkable. But this also comes after Mr. Lukashenko's odd appearance in Moscow last week at the Victory Day celebrations to mark the end of World War II. Now, this is a big occasion, not just for Russia, but it's when sympathetic leaders from other former USSR countries show up. And there was a moment during these celebrations when they all had to walk a very short distance to lay flowers. Alexander Lukashenko seemed to need a lift. Then he missed the state lunch with Vladimir Putin, which is also a very big deal. He was seen soon after that back in Belarus at his country's own World War II commemorations, but then nothing.
So what do we know about his whereabouts at the moment?
Well, the rumour is that he's been admitted to a hospital just outside the capital, Minsk, with some kind of serious illness. But as you can imagine, there's feverish speculation about whether this is true. I've been looking at Twitter, and I've got to say, every minute you have more and more people tweeting their theory about what's happened to Alexander Lukashenko. Some say he's already dead. There are all sorts of ideas doing the round.
But if something were to happen to Mr. Lukashenko, who would be likely to replace him?
As so often happens, when you have a dictator or a tyrant who disappears from the picture, there's no clear succession. It leaves a vacuum with all sorts of people jockeying for position. Now, this would be a destabilising event anyway, but the timing means it's going to be particularly turbulent if it does happen. Because, first of all, you have these people, yes, jockeying for position in Belarus. Secondly, there is a democratic opposition, some within the country, some outside in exile. They'll be hoping this is the moment when Belarus perhaps becomes more democratic. But thirdly, Vladimir Putin, for the reasons I've just explained, will want to have an influence on who takes over. He's not just going to sit back and say, well, I wonder who ends up running Belarus. I can guarantee at this moment, Vladimir Putin will be getting reports on Mr. Lukashenko's whereabouts. He will be planning his move.
Paul Moss. The British Academy Television Awards have been taking place in London. Kate Winslet won Best Leading Actress for her performance in I Am Ruth, about a mother who tries to help her depressed teenage daughter. And Ben Whishaw took the Leading Actor Award for a medical drama called This Is Going to Hurt. Other winners included the comedy series Derry Girls and the reality show The Traitors. Our culture correspondent Stefan Powell was at the ceremony.
And the BAFTA goes to
Derry Girls.
Derry Girls said a fitting farewell to fans who watched its finale last year by winning two BAFTAs tonight for Best Scripted Comedy and Best Female Performance in a Comedy, which went to Siobhan McSweeney for her role as hard-nosed headteacher Sister Michael. Elsewhere, I Am Ruth also won two awards for leading actress Kate Winslet and also Best Single Drama. Reality show The Traitors won two, as did the BBC for its coverage of the Platinum Jubilee, including last year's memorable moment, Paddington and the late Queen having tea. A key player in that sketch, Ben Whishaw, who voiced the bear from Peru, also walked away with the award for Best Actor in a Leading Role for his portrayal of Dr. Adam Kay in This Is Gonna Hurt.
Stefan Powell reporting. Now, if you find the wait between seasons of your favourite TV shows agonising, prepare for it to get even worse. Because with the writers' strike in Hollywood now about to enter its third week, production is being disrupted on more and more shows, including fan favourites like Stranger Things, Hacks and Yellowjackets. Regan Morris sent this report from Los Angeles.
1, 2, 3, 4, stop the strike and pay us more.
Streaming has completely upended the way that our industry functions.
Brittany Nichols is a writer on the hit comedy Abbott Elementary. She says studios need to rethink their business models and show more respect to writers.
In case we have members of our union that aren't able to qualify for health care because they're not making the minimum amount, our pay is down, and we're just asking for a fair shake. You know, what we're asking for is less than 2% of the profits that we bring in.
Writing for Abbott Elementary is one of the most stable jobs in TV because it's for an old-school network, not a streaming service. It offers 22 episodes of work, enough to make a very good living and have job security and health benefits for the year. But not all writers enjoy this security. Streaming services often hire writers for just a few weeks in what writers call mini rooms, small groups of writers doing what large groups used to do and for a shorter time. Writers say they're pressured to do free rewrites and they struggle to move from gig to gig.
They are beholden to shareholders, not to the audience, and this constant seeking of growth, right? This isn't possible. It's not possible to continue to grow these subscription models because eventually you run out of people. And if you build your business around that, that's bad business.
The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents the studios, said in a statement that they approach the negotiations with the long-term health and stability of the industry as a priority. They also said their goal is to keep production active and deliver the best entertainment available in the world. The writers do not want production to remain active, not while they're on strike, and they've been setting up noisy picket lines outside the studio gates.
Oh, it's all right.
And you never know who you're going to meet on a picket line. That's Jason Sudeikis, the writer and star behind Apple TV hit Ted Lasso.
I mean, you're just talking about the haves and the have-nots. This is, you know, this is a tale as old as wine. And, you know, I mean, I was working on Saturday Night Live during the 2007-2008 strike, and a lot has changed. And yet one of the things that hasn't changed is that the people that make all that money still make even more money. And I'm talking about, you know, people that run the studios and looking here is asking, you know, people just to get their just desserts, you know. It's like they're not asking to sing for their supper. They've already sang. They just want to eat now.
The writers and studios are also deadlocked on how Hollywood should deal with AI, artificial intelligence. As the technology becomes more sophisticated, writers want assurances that humans will still be employed to write in the future. Ian Oliver Perry is a writer's assistant on a Netflix show.
They want to replace all writers. If it was up to the studios, AI would pitch the idea and then they'd write the entire episode. All the actors would be automatically generated. No, there would be no more humans because that hurts their bottom line.
While many fear being replaced by AI, writer Kevin Coppola says the studios should be wary of the technology.
Are you worried about AI?
I don't know much about it, but I do know that AI is going to cost a lot of money as well. So wait till they start asking. Whoever controls that is going to start asking for a fortune as well. And we'll see what happens then.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
That's right.
President Joe Biden called for a fair deal for Hollywood's writers as he hosted a White House screening of the upcoming streaming series, American Born Chinese.
Nights like these are a reminder of the power of stories and the importance of treating storytellers with dignity, respect, and the value they deserve. I sincerely hope the writer's strike in Hollywood gets resolved and the writers are given a fair deal they deserve as soon as possible.
Many here hope the same. The last writer's strike lasted more than 100 days and cost the California economy an estimated $2 billion.
That report by Regan Morris. The English city of Liverpool is basking in the success of the Eurovision Song Contest, which it's been hosting on behalf of last year's winners, Ukraine. Swedish artist Loreen won the final on Saturday night with her song Tattoo, becoming the first woman and only the second person to do so twice. It's estimated a staggering 160 million people watched the event. The BBC's Paul Henley was in Liverpool, and my colleague Julian Marshall asked him if the Swedish entry was a worthy winner this year.
I would say that she was a worthy winner, although she was always the favourite in this competition. And from the start, actually, it seemed pretty much like a foregone conclusion. But if anybody understands Eurovision, it's the Swedes. And if anybody understands exactly how to win, it's probably Loreen, who is only the second person ever to win twice. You might remember a song called Euphoria, which was a global hit that she won with in 2012. And she's sort of a Eurovision creation. She's her own special thing, Loreen. She doesn't really require language. She seems like a sort of earthy creation, specially for Eurovision. And her performance was pretty stunning by most descriptions, I think.
And, Paul, what were the other standout acts for you?
Well, I like a mad act. I thought that Serbia, who are top of the mad poll in most Eurovision Song Contests, might have stormed it this year. I was completely wrong. They came near the bottom. But A Boy Lost in Space, connected by umbilical cords to some weird strutting droids and being sort of born in a soap dish, I thought that was fairly weird. And I embraced the weird of Eurovision. There were a lot of standard dance numbers, including from Israel, who took third place, and from Poland, and a sort of Game of Thrones imitation from Norway. What other countries do that the UK has never entirely embraced is the strange. And I felt that the audience in Liverpool this year was embracing the strange.
Although Ukraine were not the hosts, there was a very, very strong Ukraine theme, was there not, Paul, running through Eurovision this year?
The whole city was bedecked in yellow and blue flags, and everybody who was celebrating Eurovision was aware that they were doing it for a reason. They were doing it on behalf of Ukraine. There was a genuinely moving moment towards the end of the contest last night when a previous winner, Duncan Lawrence, started up a chorus of You'll Never Walk Alone as part of a Liverpool songbook presentation. And the cameras cut to Ruslana, a former Ukrainian dancer in Kiev, joining in. And the whole of the audience sang this anthem from Merseyside, dedicated to war-torn Ukraine. And it was, I think, powerful.
And Sweden will host next year's competition in what will be an auspicious year for both Sweden and indeed Eurovision.
You're talking about 50 years since ABBA won in 1974 with Waterloo. Yes, they'll probably host in Gothenburg, and I think there will be a lot of ABBA theming in next year's Eurovision. ABBA, of course, by far the most successful act that has ever emerged from the competition.
Paul Henley. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark. The producer was Lipika Pelham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
In March 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a massive tsunami. It plunged Japan into the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are at war! An invisible enemy is trying to occupy Japan!
Fukushima, an original 7-part audio drama from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the heroes who fought to contain the disaster.
Our job is clear.
to cool the reactors. You'll be risking your life to save Japan.
And of those living with its impact.
I'm connected to the disaster. I'll never be able to separate myself from it.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.